Welcome to AfterSight's High Country News Program. I'm KG Greenspun, reading from the April edition. The Great Solar Buildout. Public land managers ponder where to allow utility-scale solar projects, by Aaron X. Wong. The Western U.S. is home to some of the most abundant solar energy in the world. The Southwest region, from California to New Mexico, receives on average more solar radiation per day than anywhere else in the country. In January, the Bureau of Land Management released a draft environmental analysis of the updated Western Solar Plan, a federal blueprint that shows where developers can apply for permits to build solar projects on BLM-administered public lands in the West. The new version revises a 2012 plan, adding more states and redrawing the lines around which areas should be protected from and which should be open to large-scale solar development. The agency has proposed five alternatives for where to draw those lines. The plan is focused on utility-scale solar projects that sell energy to utility companies that power cities and towns. Most utility-scale projects use the same technology as rooftop solar, but they operate on a much larger scale, sometimes covering thousands of acres in solar panels. After the BLM announced the upcoming revisions in late 2022, hundreds of public comments were sent in. People applauded the timely update, raised concerns about key natural habitats, and emphasized the need for early and ongoing consultation with tribes. Some of these ideas are now reflected in the current draft. Meanwhile, the BLM is accepting comments until April 18th, once the new Western Solar Plan is finalized, possibly by the end of this year. All proposed solar developments will undergo an individual review before approval. The Solar Imperative. The U.S. needs solar development to meet its renewable energy goals, which include a 100% carbon pollution-free power grid by 2035. If the country succeeds in meeting this goal, the 11 western states in the lower 48 could have 548.6 gigawatts of electricity generation capacity by 2045, according to data from one potential scenario published by the National Renewable Energy Lab. In this scenario, approximately one-third of capacity will come from solar energy, and more than three-quarters of that will come from utility-scale solar. The Palin Solar Site on BLM land in Riverside County, California. EDF Renewables, North America. How much land will that take? The updated Western Solar Plan assumes that Western states will build more utility-scale solar capacity by 2045 than is expected in the National Renewable Energy Lab's scenario. Using high estimates to ensure sufficient land, the BLM expects the West to produce 174.2 gigawatts, enough to power 52.8 million American homes, with up to 75% of the energy developed on BLM land and the remainder on private, tribal, state, or other federal land. As of December 2022, the BLM had already permitted 73,000 acres of public land for solar projects totaling 9.2 gigawatts. Here are three of the BLM's five proposed alternatives, along with its estimate of how much land will actually be developed. The BLM administers approximately 173 million acres in 11 western states, including the majority of Nevada and large swaths of Wyoming and Utah. 55 million acre alternative. The broadest alternative proposed would leave all areas open except for those with known cultural and ecological resources, such as sacred tribal sites, scenic byways, sage grouse habitat, and old growth forests. 22 million acre alternative. The BLM's preferred alternative would also exclude all those cultural and ecological resources while opening only regions within a 10-mile radius of existing and planned transmission lines. 11 million acre alternative. Another alternative would also exclude those resources and open only previously disturbed land. Ultimately, about 1 million acres of BLM land in the West will need to be developed to meet the nation's clean energy goals, according to the draft analysis. This includes nearly 700,000 acres under the Western Solar Plan, along with roughly 283,000 acres of BLM land in California, which are covered under a separate renewable energy and conservation plan. Altogether, the estimated acreage required for utility scale solar is only a fraction of the 19 million acres of BLM land in the western states with active oil and gas leases as of 2022. And now also under reportage, how states make money off tribal lands. To this day, 10 states own 1.6 million acres of land within 83 tribal nations reservations by Anna V. Smith and Maria Perazzo Rose. Before John Eagle Sr. began working for the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe, he was an equine therapist for over 36 years, linking horses with and providing support to children, families, and communities, both on his ranch and on the road. The work reinforced his familiarity with the land and allowed him to explore the rolling hills, plains, and buttes of the sixth largest reservation in the United States. But when he became Standing Rock's tribal historic preservation officer, he learned that the land still held surprises, the biggest one being that much of it didn't belong to the tribe. Standing Rock straddles North and South Dakota, and both states own thousands of acres within the tribe's reservation boundaries. "They don't talk to us at all about it," Eagle said. "I wasn't even aware that there were lands like that here." On the North Dakota side, nearly 23,500 acres of Standing Rock are owned by the state, along with another 70,000 subsurface acres, a land classification that refers to underground resources, including oil and gas. The combined 93,500 acres, known as trust lands, are held and managed by the state and produce revenue for its public schools and the Bank of North Dakota. The amount of reservation land South Dakota controls is unknown. The state does not make public its trust land data and did not supply it after a public records request. And Standing Rock isn't alone. Data analyzed by Grist and High Country News reveal that a combined 1.6 million surface and subsurface acres of state trust lands lie within the borders of 83 federal Indian reservations in 10 states. State trust lands, which are managed by state agencies, generate millions of dollars for public schools, universities, penitentiaries, hospitals, and other state institutions, typically through grazing, logging, mining, and oil and gas production. Although federal Indian reservations were established for the use and governance of indigenous nations and their citizens, the existence of state trust lands reveals a shocking truth. States rely on indigenous land and resources to support non-indigenous institutions and services for non-indigenous people. Tribal nations have no control over this land, and many states do not consult with tribes about how it's used. The world of state trust lands is itself rather obscure, but these states' holdings within reservations have been almost completely unknown until now. Many of the experts Grist and High Country News reached out to, including longtime policymakers and leaders on indigenous issues, were unfamiliar with state trust lands' history and acreage. However, what sources did make clear is that the presence of state lands on reservations complicates issues of tribal jurisdiction in regard to land use and management and undercuts tribal sovereignty. According to Rob Williams, University of Arizona law professor and citizen of the Lumbee Tribe of North Carolina, this has broad implications for everything from the handling of missing and murdered indigenous people to tribal nations' ability to confront climate change. When there's clarity about jurisdiction over Indian lands, it's easier for tribes to work with others to protect public safety, public health, and the natural environment, said Brian Newland, Assistant Secretary for Indian Affairs at the Department of Interior and citizen of the Bay Mills Indian Community. It's been the long-standing policy of the department to reduce checkerboard jurisdiction within reservations by consolidating tribal lands and strengthening the ability of tribes to exercise their sovereign authorities over their own lands. The creation of Indian reservations was followed closely by states entering the Union, which in turn was followed by successful attempts by state governments to carve up and dissolve those tribal lands. Once states became part of the U.S., they received millions of acres of recently ceded tribal lands, many of which became trust lands. But as more settlers moved west, states pushed for more land. In the late 19th and early 20th centuries, the U.S. government responded by carving up Indian reservations, parceling out small amounts of land to individual tribal members, then handing over surplus lands for states, settlers, and federal projects. During this period, known as the allotment era, approximately 90 million acres of reservation lands nationwide were moved from tribal hands to non-native ownership. According to Monty Mills, professor of law at the University of Washington and director of the Native American Law Center, allotments served a dual purpose. It broke up tribal power and gave non-native citizens access to tribal lands and natural resources. The allotment system, Mills explained, provided a whole other set of opportunities for non-Indian settlers to get access to surplus lands and for the states to come in and get more state trust lands on lands that had been expressly off limits. As Williams put it, the conquest was by law. The implications of that policy are just devastating, Williams said. It's hard to think of a single problem in Indian law that you can't blame it in part on. For example, nearly 512,000 surface and subsurface acres on the Ute tribe's Uinta and Ouray reservation came into Utah's possession after a series of murky state and federal policies and land transfers. A quarter of the tribe's 4-million-acre reservation was taken by President Theodore Roosevelt for a national forest, while other land went to provide town sites and establish trust lands. By 1933, 91% of the Uinta and Ouray reservation had been allotted. In other cases, as with the Yakama Nation, states acquired parcels when reservation boundaries were redrawn, shortly after the tribe ceded over 12 million acres in central Washington, the agreed upon map of its new reservation simply disappeared, sparking nearly a century of border disputes between the Yakima Nation, the state, and the federal government, specifically over a 121,000 acre section known as Tract D. In the 1930s, the map was rediscovered by an employee in the Federal Office of Indian Affairs, apparently misfiled under M for Montana. In 2021, the Ninth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals ruled that Tract D was still a part of the original reservation. But in the meantime, Washington State had established trust lands inside the area. Today, 108,000 surface, subsurface, and timber acres inside the recently recognized borders of the Yakima Nation are still providing revenue for the state's K-12 schools, scientific schools, and penal and reform institutions. This makes up 78% of all state trust lands on the Yakima Reservation. Washington's Department of Natural Resources, or DNR, is responsible for managing these lands. An agency spokesperson said the Yakima Treaty retained many rights for tribal members on public lands throughout the ceded territory of the Yakima, and DNR's management of these trust lands continues to be done with much input from the Yakima Nation. Michael Dolson has spent most of his life on the western side of the Confederated Salish and Kootenai tribes' Flathead Reservation, living on the family ranch, which his great-grandparents started before allotment. Today, a map of the reservation shows large squares of state trust land parcels located not far from his family's land. A total of 108,000 surface and subsurface acres that fund Montana's K-12 schools and the University of Montana. Dolson, now the tribe's chairman, says that the state lands on the reservation are managed separately. The tribe has no input over how or whether Montana decides to log or lease them. Since different groups have different objectives, Dolson says, this complicates the tribe's ability to manage its own reservation. I think we've gotten used to lands on the res being owned by others, and they make use of those lands the way they want to, Dolson said. Do we appreciate that? Well, no, especially when its parcels have some sort of cultural significance to us, and we have no control over it, even though they're on our reservation. For more than a decade, the Confederated Salish and Kootenai tribes have carefully planned for climate change, documenting and developing tools like drought resiliency plans to limit its possible impacts. Meanwhile, Montana continues to prioritize oil and gas and coal production, making extraction one of the biggest sources of its trust land revenue. Like many other tribes, the Confederated Salish and Kootenai tribes has had to buy back its own land at or above market value. After allotment, less than a third of the reservation, about 30%, remained in tribal ownership. According to Dolson, about 60% of the Flathead Reservation, or 791,000 acres, is currently back in tribal ownership, following decades of strategic work. Yet, Montana still controls 8% of the reservation as state trust land. States are legally obliged to make money from state trust lands to benefit state institutions, so they are unlikely to return any land without getting something in exchange. But the Confederated Salish and Kootenai tribes may have created a model for how tribes can negotiate for large-scale transfers of land back to tribal ownership. In 2020, Congress passed a water rights settlement that cleared the way for a transfer of nearly 30,000 acres of Montana State Trust land back to the tribe. In exchange, the state will receive federal lands elsewhere. The acreage is currently in the process of being selected over the next 5 years. It's a creative and unique arrangement, but one that presents opportunities if states are willing to work with tribes. The Biden administration's policy is to assist tribes in reacquiring tribal homelands, but the policy is silent on the issue of state trust lands on reservations. There is currently no clear mechanism to return those lands to tribes, meaning tribal nations are left without buying land outright, sometimes for millions of dollars. According to Rob Williams at the University of Arizona, the biggest issue now, and this is the burden on the tribes, is land back. Encounters, an exploration of life and landscape during the climate crisis. Youth are leading the way on climate action. Grown-ups are falling down on the job, by Ruxandra Guidi. In 2006, a pint-sized six-year-old with hair down to his waist stood in front of a crowd of around 300 people at a climate rally. He clutched the microphone stand as if it was about to run away from him and held a sheet of notes that he barely glanced at. Then, in his little voice, Chutescat Martinez said something remarkable. Most kids don't even know that the world is sacred, he said. That's because they spend most of their time in front of their TV or in front of their video game. It's time for their parents to get them out of their house and show them that Mother Earth is a sacred thing. In a video of the event, you can see the audience cheering and clapping. Martinez pauses, a smile taking shape on his face. I would never have expected a six-year-old to understand that the planet matters more than playing video games. A six-year-old shouldn't have to care about climate change. Martinez, who identifies as Mexica, a descendant of the Aztecs, is now a 23-year-old artist and activist, and one of 21 plaintiffs in 2015's Juliana versus United States, which was among the first lawsuits in the U.S. to use atmospheric trust litigation to hold the government responsible for its actions and inactions related to climate change. The foundations for atmospheric trust litigation were laid at the University of Oregon's Environmental and Natural Resources Law Program, but the nonprofit law firm Our Children's Trust was the first to employ it as a legal approach. That lawsuit was followed by a series of similar ones. Most of them come from the Western U.S., Oregon, Montana, California, Alaska, Utah, Hawaii, and involve young people of Black or Indigenous backgrounds who represent the communities most affected. Juliana versus United States argued that the U.S. government willfully ignored the dangers of burning fossil fuels, violating the plaintiff's constitutional rights to life, liberty, and property, and failing to protect a public trust resources. Youth-led movements aren't a novel phenomenon. According to Australian sociologist Judith Besant's Making Up People, Youth, Truth, and Politics, young people have been at the forefront of political movements since at least the 18th century. Many of the abolitionists who were active on the Underground Railroad were barely 20. In the 1960s, youth played a major role in the civil rights and anti-war movements. Julia Butterfly Hill was 23 when she prevented the logging of a 1,000-year-old redwood in California, and Greta Thunberg was just 15 when she launched her global strike for the climate, inspiring millions to do the same. Some aging liberals have a knack for caricaturing young people as immature, impulsive, and lacking good judgment. Critics often slight their intelligence and their supposed disengagement from politics. Yet the imaginative and bold approach they're taking today reminds the rest of us of how much there is at stake. They're exposing why their seniors' tacit or overt excuse for disengagement. We won't be alive to see the ravages of the climate crisis anyway is beyond unacceptable. Uliana versus the United States has faced many delays and hurdles in the past almost decade. At the end of February, the Department of Justice tried to stay and dismiss the case. On the other hand, last August, Held versus Montana, Wynn, expanded the possibilities for using atmospheric trust litigation against the government by ruling that young people have a right to a healthy environment. Cases like this are moving slowly through the legal system, with some expected to end up in the Supreme Court. Andrea Rogers, a senior litigation attorney at Our Children's Trust and co-counsel in Uliana versus United States, has said that the impacts of climate change represent a violation of human rights and children's rights. The Fifth Amendment of the U.S. Constitution, which Rogers uses in her arguments, establishes that no person shall be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. Life itself, that most seminal right, is what's at stake here. It's painfully obvious if you read the headlines. 2023 was the hottest year on record. The associated charts are scary. The red line showing the temperature increase starts at zero and holds steady throughout the 1850s, a decade when slavery was still legal and westward expansion was already fomenting indigenous genocide and displacement. But within just seven decades, that red line climbs in an ever sharper curve today, when it hovers around 1.5 degrees Celsius, or 2.7 degrees Fahrenheit. This is significant because climate experts have long agreed that if we want to prevent potentially irreversible impacts, we need to make sure that the world's average temperature does not exceed that of pre-industrial times by more than 1.5 degrees Celsius. We can't keep expecting young people to carry the torch for us while powerful grown-ups and politicians endanger all of us by failing to make difficult but urgent policy decisions. Young people across the West continue to make the case for radical change. We should be long past proposing greener policies or waiting for local and state courts to take on these cases. So what would it look like if adults joined the fray? If we think beyond litigation and use our money and our deeds in the service of science-based climate political action, we can galvanize more people around us. We can shame our representatives the way the young plaintiffs are doing by representing them and us in the courtroom. Back in 2006, six-year-old Shute Scott Martinez said, "There are simple things you can do in your own homes, like not let the water run or turn off the lights when you're not using them. You could teach these things to your children. Every choice we make is for or against our future." And that's the time. Thank you for joining me. You're listening to Aftersight.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aftersight.org or by calling 303-786-7777.